Good afternoon, and welcome to We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And I'm Bob Martin.
Bob, do you have a new microphone?
I do.
Why does it look so fluffy over there?
It's a different model.
It's like you're talking into a giant ho-ho.
I'm hurt. He's got a better microphone than me.
Bob's like a radio announcer over there.
The old announcer's microphone was really on its last legs.
Yeah, well, that's very fancy. So
it was like sounding distorted every time I spoke.
Now you sound just like you.
Yes.
Huh.
Yes.
Well, look at that. We haven't been here for a few weeks. So to all the
people, all kinds of changes while you were gone.
Yeah, to all the people who were frustrated that we kept doing repeats and different things. We had ball game and then a couple of repeats, and sorry about that. Just had some stuff. We had stuff. There was stuff.
And then I had a ball game.
Yeah, and then you had a ball game, and my niece got married, so okay, we're done. Phew, done with all that.
I had to wash the dog.
Okay, just to be clear, we're live on August 13th, 2017.
I know, and we're really proud of it.
Yeah.
We're super proud of it. Oh, my gosh. And so we thought, okay, haven't been here for a bit. We've been airing some different stuff. And, you know, I would really like to ask people to, I know I tell you this every week, but for real, send me ideas. If, you know, everyone listens to different things. Everybody has different networks of news and websites and books that you read and radio programs you listen to at other times of the day other than Sundays from noon to 2 Pacific. But you're all being impacted by all this stuff. When you hear somebody interesting, would you please shoot that to me? Don't assume we are able to cover everything because you can't be everywhere. You can email me at Erin, E-R-I-N, at wethepeopleradio.us. You can also call me if you'd like. And this is all posted on the website, by the way. But if you'd like to call me, it's 530-515-7135. And just in case you were thinking of doing it right now, my phone is on mute. I am all over this thing. I think I slept like 11 hours last night. I caught up with, you know, the last 2 weeks.
I'm going to call it right now and make sure.
Yeah, it's too late. I'm going to call you because I know yours isn't muted.
You're right.
Anyway, so that was 530-515-7135. So, yeah, we'd like your ideas. You can text that number, too, if you'd rather be, you know, not have to waste the time of the phone call. But we'd like your thoughts. We'd like your guests and your topics. So authors always like to come on because they like to talk about their books. So if you're reading something fun, let us know.
Yeah.
And so the world is actually has become as strange as fiction. I think everyone's noticed that. But we hear a lot about the opioid crisis, like every day.
Donald Trump's fault, though, isn't it?
Of course, well, that just goes...
Yeah. We haven't even touched on that part of it yet.
We haven't even gone there.
Yeah.
I do have a really interesting... I'm hoping that program will be next week. I have something interesting for you. So keep an eye on the website, which is wethepeopleradio.us. I think you know that. But anyway, if you're curious about the opioid thing, we thought we'd have Dr. Philip Drum back on with us. He came on and talked about marijuana, which... That was amazingly interesting, and I've spent the last few weeks going out and asking people, hey, did you know this? Hey, did you know this? Nobody knows this stuff. They really don't. I kind of got in a discussion with my nephew about medical marijuana at the wedding. That's how things all go wrong. But
we got a lot of comments on this show last time, too.
But we did get a lot of comments, and kids don't. He's 20, maybe. I think he's 20. He didn't know any of that. He didn't know that any of the synthetic forms of marijuana have been available since 1985. All this stuff is stuff that we should know as taxpayers and as citizens. Because
well,
people
it's been drowned out by the medical marijuana crowd.
Right. And we learned last time that was all so that they could pass legal marijuana and just get high. So we're good with that. I will post that show from a few weeks ago. I forget what the date was.
It was July 16th.
Yep, July 16th. There you have it. And I'll pop that on here as well. But Dr. Philip Trum received his doctorate in pharmacy from the University of California, San Francisco. He's a licensed pharmacist and has been for 31 years. He has a wide range of experience from community pharmacy practice, a residency hospital pharmacy. He's practiced as a hospital-based oncology pharmacist, a pharmacy administrator working as a clinical coordinator, and later a regional manager and leader of a regional pharmacy training and patient safety program. He's been active in pharmacy associations and has spoken statewide and nationally on a variety of pharmaceutical topics. And then as a result of a family tragedy, the loss of his sister, which we discussed on the 16th, he has been active in researching in the research on driving and marijuana and educating the public over the dangers of marijuana in society. So as this whole opioid thing was just droning on, and it's a huge issue. I mean, it really is a huge issue. But I thought, you know, I'm pretty positive this is connected in some way to the marijuana issue. So there, I relinquish. Now I know. I know.
Relinquish the microphone.
I know nothing beyond this point. That's the extent. So, Dr. Drum, where would you like to start today?
Well, we can probably start with some statistics that have come out from the Center for Disease Control. About an estimated 11.2% of the U.S. population has a prevalence for chronic pain. 11.2% are in chronic pain. About 3 to 4% of the U.S. population use opiates for long term, which is defined as for more than 3 months. So again, 3 to 4% of our population is using it for long term use. As you mentioned, there are a lot of overdoses in the United States as a result of opiate overdoses. And in a 15-year period that the CDC looked at from 1999 to 2014, there were greater than 165,000 deaths in the United States over that 15-year period, so a good 10,000 deaths a year on average. And in 2013, about 1.9 million abused or are dependent on prescription opioid pain medication.
Wow.
So I'll kind of start things off with that and open it up to any type of questions you may have.
On the on that statistic you had on the number of deaths, does that include heroin overdoses and, you know, illegal drugs, or is that primarily prescription medication?
Yeah, it was related to opiates. I'm not exactly sure if it included heroin or not. I'm not sure. But as the states began ratcheting down, as we started seeing this issue occur in about the mid-2000s, states started ratcheting down the free prescriptions of controlled substances because we were seeing these deaths occurring. And it kind of slowly spread across the United States. And so over time, it's taken time to finally get a lot of states to have what we call prescription drug monitoring programs. And we have one here in California. It was started in the early 2000s and really hasn't revved up until about now. The last couple of years, it's finally getting to the point in which it's utilizable. But we started seeing those deaths, so we started implementing plans to try and keep the deaths down. Unfortunately, as a result of that, well, fortunately, the number of opiate prescriptions have kind of gone down, as well as the amount dispensing has gone down, but unfortunately it's been replaced with heroin. Heroin's another opiate, and so what ends up happening is the people can no longer afford or get their hands on those prescription opiates, and they're now using heroin, another opiate, instead. And as a result of our marijuana legalization, many Mexican cartels have moved from creating marijuana to now creating heroin, because marijuana now is basically in the United States, and we in California supply 60% of the United States with the marijuana needs. And so the Mexican cartels, which are in California and growing some marijuana, but in Mexico they're growing the heroin and moving that in, and heroin's actually cheaper than marijuana on the market.
Hmm. What do you attribute the increase in opioid use? You said since the 2000s. What do you attribute the increase to?
Well, there was a study that came out in the late 90s, early 2000s that related to, and I don't remember, people remember this, was saying people in the United States were dying, especially cancer patients, were dying in pain. And so as a result of that study that came out, there was a big push from the CDC and the FDA about treating patients appropriately for their pain, and I think they actually overdid it. I can tell you at that time I was working in the VA, and we then had to start asking every veteran that came in, even if they came in for, you know, a urinary tract infection, we had to ask them about their pain score. And so as a result of that, people then started knee-jerking and started over-prescribing opiates for their pain. Again, opiates are not the first-line therapy for any type of pain, unless you're on the surgical table, that you really should be using other non-opiates and non-pharmacologic interventions first. But unfortunately, a lot of people were then prescribed opiates. They're in people's over-prescribing them from the standpoint of number of days. The recommendation that just came out recently is recommending about a three-day therapy for pain meds. So you're going to, if you go in with pain, acute pain right now, many doctors are only going to prescribe a 3 to 7 day allotment because that's the recommendation that came out of the Center for Disease Control. In the past, I'm sure many of you are aware, you'd give a good 30-day supply
of
these opiates,
probably.
And they were then in people's cabinets in their bedroom, and kids went in there and were taking those from their parents or grandparents, and the abuse then just went out of control.
I'm kind of a drug dummy. What do opioids do? Oh, hold on here. Before we find out about that, I was realizing it's past our break time. But when we come back,
it just sounds like we have to take a nap.
For us drug dummies, I want to know what opioids even do to you. Like, what do they make you feel like? Why would you want to take them? And why would you want to keep taking them, actually? So you're listening to We the People Radio. You can join us online at wethepeopleradio.us. We'll be back with Dr. Philip Drum. We're talking about the connection between opioids and pot and back and forth. So it's a day with drugs in it for you today, just for change.
I hurt myself today to see if I still feel. I focus on the pain, the only thing that's real. The needle tears a hole, the old familiar sting. Try to kill it all away, but I remember everything.
Okay, well, that reinforces my question. Why? 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 So,
do you know who that was?
Johnny Cash.
It was Johnny Cash. Very good.
Yeah, that would have been some dark, dark days. Hey, you said more hilarious music, and then that started.
That was total sarcasm.
I was like, are we talking sarcasm here? It's not hilarious. So why do what do opioids do to you, or for you, or at you?
Well, opiates hit four main opioid receptors in the body. They're found in various places. They primarily are in the brain, but they're also in the peripheral sensory neurons, out in the end, as well as in the spinal cord. And so what they do is these molecules then hit these receptors, and they hit various receptors, these opiate receptors, which then cause the pain relief. Some have antidepressant effects. Some affect the pupillary response in the eyes and cause them to have pinpoint pupils. As some people know, that it slows your gastrointestinal tract, and so you'll get constipated on these drugs, and so there are receptors, opiate receptors, the mu receptors do that. So there are various receptors, these opiate receptors, that are then getting hit by these molecules, these drugs.
Getting back to the prescribed opioids, was there ever any studies done on whether or not the doctors were getting any kind of a kickback for prescribing opioids?
Well, there have been some people that have lost their license and been jailed for that. So, yes, not studies, but individual cases. The prescription drug monitoring programs that are going on, as I mentioned, are really helping bringing this to light. I think a lot of people, especially people that are addicts, are fully aware of our system that we had in the past that was very deficient in being able to inform others that you're on opiates. And so they could go to a Rexall, then they could go to a Long's, then they could go to a Costco, then they could go to, you know, multiple different pharmacies, and none of the pharmacies were talking to each other. And we would never know that they just got a prescription for 1,000 Percocet down the street. And so with this prescription drug monitoring program now in California, the pharmacies are required to send to the state, the Department of Justice, this information every time we sell a prescription. So every tablet, every ml of product that we sell, a controlled substance 2 through 4, we have to send to the Department of Justice here in California in what's called the CURES program. And so it's controlled substance utilization, review, and evaluation system is what it stands for. And it's been around, like I said, since the early 2000s. It was implemented as a result of a net zero executive's 2 children being killed by a woman who was actually a nanny for a local news anchor. And she was found to be, again, doctor shopping, receiving opiates and benzodiazepines from multiple providers and multiple pharmacies, none of which talked to each other, and weren't required to. And so as a result of that, the Net Zero Executive helped push through the CURES program here in California, which, again, now is a system that we report to the State Department of Justice, and they're able to look at it and look and see who the providers are. They'll see who the patients are, what they're receiving, how much, when, from what pharmacy, who's prescribing it. They get the DEA number of the prescriber as well as of the pharmacy that filled it, the date it was filled. And so they get all of that information, and from that they're able to run queries and determine, you know, if providers are over-prescribing.
Hmm. Well, that makes sense. You were telling me the other day, though, when we were chatting on the phone, you were telling me there's some kind of a delay they've implemented because it takes time for that information to go through the system.
Well, we really don't like talking about that too much, but there was one. Oh. There was a delay in the past, I could tell you, and I know in the past, I don't know right now if the VA's prescribing is going into the state as well. I would hope they would, so they could go to different organizations like that, the feds, and they may not feed to the state. But it was back in the early 2000s when I tried out this system to see how it was working when I was at the VA, and it took like 90 days to get the report back from the state. So clearly, you know, if you're a pharmacy and you're dispensing at the window there, you want to know right away, did they get 1,000 Percocet down the road? You don't want to find that out 3 days later that they were doing that. So they've now implemented CURES 2.0, which is now more live, and we can get that information much quicker. And there was also a bill that was passed recently that now requires the provider to look before they first prescribe controlled substances to a patient. They must look into the CURE system to see if this patient is receiving from other providers.
And then if they, let's just say they didn't, and they prescribed 2, it would show that they were the second one, and I'm assuming they get in some kind of trouble?
Yeah, I don't know about that yet. I would actually recommend considering, and for those of you that are in legislation, I'd actually recommend considering a bounty. Because I don't see a problem with that. And if a pharmacist is catching the provider for doing that, we should probably receive a benefit for that from the state, that we are catching providers that are over-prescribing drugs then in this case.
Because what happens now?
Again, we would call the doctor and say, hey, are you aware that Dr., you know, Dr. B, are you aware that Dr. A prescribed 1,000 Percocet yesterday or, you know, 10 days ago? And if they still want to prescribe it, then we could then, you know, notify the state. We called Dr. B, and he still thinks it's another 1,000 Percocet is appropriate for this patient. We'll leave it to you to decide, Department of Justice.
Would you call someone now? I mean,
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, okay. Who do you call?
If I find out that they're receiving excessive amounts, and again, there's some guidelines now that have come out in March of 2016 that, again, are recommending a 3 to 7 day period for acute pain. And for chronic pain, they have 12 recommendations for prescribers as to how to do that, how to prescribe for patient opiates for mainly chronic pain patients. But if they're not adhering to those 12 recommendations, oh, absolutely, I would be contacting the provider.
Interesting. And then if the providers, like if you, in your example, if Dr. B says, yeah, I want to give them 1,000, even though they got 1,000 yesterday from Dr. A,
I would notify the Department of Justice.
Yeah, okay.
Or my other option, obviously, is I don't dispense it. Again, it really depends on you know my clinical assessment of the patient. If because it's my license on the line as well as the doctor's, and so if I dispense him, you know, the 1,000 Percocet after he got 1,000 2 days ago, my license is on the line for doing that as well.
Oh, okay. So you do have the ability to reel that back in.
Oh, absolutely. And at times, kind of goes back to a little bit of a different thought, but when people were getting prescriptions and forging them, now it's a little bit more difficult because of the type of paper it has to be written on. But in the past, you know, you'd receive a prescription, you're going to close at 6 o'clock, and at 5:55 somebody comes walking in with a forged prescription. It'd always be that way. Right at the end of the day, here they come waltzing in with a forged prescription. And so typically what we would do is we'd recognize it as a forgery, and we would stamp it with our prescription number and then say, oops, you know, we're out of Percocet today, and hand it back to them. What that does is it alerts the next pharmacy that they tried bringing it to that a pharmacy already saw it, and now they're trying to bring it to them.
Yeah. Oh, that's a pretty good idea. So this stuff's been going on forever. I mean, obviously.
Absolutely.
That's why
they're controlled substances.
Sure.
And again, our good friend that we talked about last time is a controlled substance, one, marijuana, the most highly addictive substances that are out there. These are controlled substances that are highly addictive and have a dependency syndrome and elicit physical responses when somebody is cut off of these agents. So there's five classes of controlled substance, CS1, are drugs like marijuana, fencyclidine, PCP, LSD, drugs that have no medical approved indications from the Food and Drug Administration. And again, I'm saying marijuana, not talking THC, because THC has been approved by the Food and Drug Administration, as you mentioned, back in 1985. But marijuana is comprised of multiple cannabinoids, and multiple other substances in that green leafy vegetable.
Yeah.
So there are CS1 drugs that have no medical indication. Again, you cannot prescribe those drugs legally in the United States. Again, as most people know, or probably not too keenly aware, that it's called a recommendation here in California for marijuana. It's not a prescription. It's not a prescription. It is a recommendation. That's why pharmacists are not filling these drugs, because they're not prescriptions. They're just simply a recommendation. CS2 drugs are those drugs that have a medical indication for use that are the most highly addictive substances. And actually, we moved an agent that used to be a CS3 into CS2. Do you guys know what that drug was? Within the last couple of years.
I've been trying to cut back on my drugs. Really?
Have you ever heard the drug called Vicodin?
Yeah, but I don't know what it does. Is it a pain pill?
So Vicodin is kind of similar to Tylenol with codeine,
because
it's a different opiate. And so it contains acetaminophen or Tylenol. And so that was moved from a CS3 to a CS2 drug within the last couple of years because of its addiction potential and overuse. CS2 drugs cannot be refilled. So when you receive a prescription for a CS2, there's no refills on it. You have to get a prescription every time for a CS2 drug. So these are drugs like morphine, fentanyl, hydromorphone, again, all these strong, very strong opiate drugs. Vicodin now is added to that. CS3 drugs are now drugs that have a little bit less addiction potential, and so our main drug in there right now is Tylenol with codeine. And so that's a CS3 drug. CS4 drugs are your sedatives. Those are your benzodiazepines, and so those are the drugs that kind of end in PAM, drugs like lorazepam or Ativan, diazepam or Valium. There's oxazepam. So the drugs that kind of end in PAM endings, those are benzodiazepines, those are sedatives or sleeping agents. So those are your CS4. And CS5 drugs are typically low-dose opiate amounts, things like cough syrups that have codeine in them. That's a CS5. So in the cure system, we have to report to the state CS2s through 4s every sale that we make.
That makes sense. And if people are using their insurance, are people just not using their insurance? Because I'm thinking if you use your insurance and you're trying to fill like at multiple pharmacies or that kind of thing, I would think your insurance would jam you.
And that would be something that was catching before the cure system. The insurance companies would see that. So again, they could be going to multiple pharmacies which do not have interconnectivity, but obviously that insurance plan is, and they would be seeing them coming in from multiple pharmacies. And absolutely, they will restrict and reply back and hopefully notify physicians about the fact that this person's doctor shopping, going to multiple providers, multiple pharmacies. So they would have the ability, absolutely.
Where would marijuana fall on that scale, on that C scale?
Well, that's a very interesting question, because it's not a prescription. Yeah, who's reporting it anywhere?
Oh.
That's pretty pathetic, isn't it? Here we are. Reporting to the state of California, CS2s through 4s, but we're not reporting sales of CS1s. Isn't that stupid?
Right. Yeah.
Shouldn't we be?
Why wouldn't you be?
Right. And so, unfortunately, the pot industry owns our legislature, and they're not going to pass any bill that requires them to report marijuana sales to the state. I think they should. So let's get our legislature to write that bill to say that marijuana sales should be reported to the cure system. Why not?
Right.
We know that it interacts with other drugs like opiates and benzodiazepines.
Yeah, no kidding.
Well, those sales should be reported to the state. If people are then concerned that their potrepreneur or their gongenarian is going to be able to take a look at the cure system, they could easily create it and make it a one-way system that reports the amount to the cure system, not allowing them to see other medically indicated medications like their opiate purchases and their benzodiazepine purchases. They could make it a one-way system and allow then the other pot shops to see that the guy just bought, 5 pounds worth of marijuana at another shop just like 2 days ago. What's stopping them from doing that right now?
Yeah, nothing.
Well, the fact that they've just legalized it in California and some of the other states, I mean, it's going to be next to impossible now to track that, isn't it?
But why didn't they even do it for medical marijuana?
Right.
Isn't that a curiosity?
Yeah, exactly.
We had that since 1996.
Yeah, because that's how they got their foot in the door was
we
had medical.
Well, and they were planning this all along.
Sure.
And so, again, this was done for 20 years in this state. And again, as I mentioned, we developed the cure system in the early 2000s. Believe me, I've tried
that
to make them be
bizarre.
Put in the cure system. The legislature won't listen.
Of course. And, of course, we're talking about the California legislature, which would be everybody else probably has a better one, but the bottom of the barrel. We'll be right back. We've got to take a really quick break for some. Are we having some funny music now, or is this going to be sad music?
Oh, it's appropriate music.
Yeah, come on. That's not your deal.
I didn't want to mislead. Yeah, no. Oh, you can find us online.
Not a lot of Ray Stevens material out there.
Yeah, probably not.
For this topic.
You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
Tried to make me go to rehab. I said no, no, no. Yes, I've been black, but when I come back, no.
Sit down, it's just talk. Smiles politely back at you. You stare politely right on through. Some sort of window to your right. She goes left and you stay right. Between the lines, fear and blame. You begin to wonder why you came. Where did I go wrong?
And there you have it. Okay, so Bill was curious about, we were talking during the break about alcohol. So when people always say, you know, all the time that marijuana and alcohol are basically the same and alcohol is not on any of those lists. And so, like, what do you say to people about that? Give us a good response we can use.
Don't mix it with opioids for starters.
Because we're sick of that one.
Right, and that's the pot industry loves to throw that back at people's faces, and I guess it comes back to, let's kind of look at societal uses, okay? And unfortunately, their societal use of their hallucinogen is fairly low. And, you know, societal use of alcohol is fairly high.
Yeah.
And so I think that's in part of their problem. Again, their drug is no safe drug. As we know, the additives that they put on this product that then gets smoked without them being removed is substantial. There's pesticides, herbicides, fungicides that are sprayed onto their product that are carcinogens and mutagens, and meaning they cause cancer and they make your kid abnormal and can damage DNA. And so this is something that's found in their product that you're not spraying on alcohol that I'm aware of, you know, fungicide, herbicides.
And there's
there's a tad bit of a difference as well as societal use.
And there's no controls right now on that product as far as walking into a shop and buying it. Wherever they get it from, are they required to make sure that it's, I don't know, organic or whatever, that there's no pesticides or anything like that used on it? Or
I don't think you can grow it like that, can you?
Not at this time. Yeah, not at this time. This is something that was in Prop 65, but they're having a very hard time, from my understanding, trying to get the purity of these products below acceptable levels that are what's found on fruits and vegetables, for example. They can't. They're having a very hard time. And what, you know, is like, there was a report that came out several months ago. It was something like 42 out of 44 specimens sent in still contained unacceptable levels.
And so good luck. Yeah. So
buyer beware. Right. What's out there right now?
So a shop that sells this, if somebody came in and said, "Hey, I'm a grower and I have XYZ," they're not required to take a sample of that and send it to a lab and have it analyzed to see what's in it. They can just look at it and go, "Oh, man, that's some good-looking stuff."
Not currently, yeah. No, and there was a study done. It was a short study that was reported, I think, in Journal of American Medical Association several years back, in which they looked at the products that were being sold in, I think it was the Bay Area, Southern Cal, and Seattle, if I remember right. And the percentage of THC and CBD, cannabidiol, which is the one that they claim to be using for seizures, those percentages were not correct that they were saying on their products. Hmm. So there's no regulation. People have to realize there's nobody regulating the marijuana industry. Now they're going to be creating it, and that's where all the tax dollars are going to go. They're not going to go to schools or to the general public. They're going to be going to, and this is what's already happening in Colorado, the tax dollars that they take in are paying for their own pot industry to try and create products that are, I guess, safer, if you will. One other thing I do want to mention with alcohol. Alcohol is used socially, right? We use it, you know, we drink it at parties and things. The intent of alcohol to get drunk?
Well, how old are we now?
There are those that do, okay? And not saying there's no alcoholics. But the intent of smoking marijuana is to get high. That's the intent, is to have that hallucinogenic effect. That's not the same with alcohol, is it?
Wow. No, I mean, you can have a beer without being a, you know, without forgetting your own name.
I don't know. I haven't been to a lot of parties where people weren't just, like, getting blasted.
I mean, there are. I've kind of traveled out of that circle.
What percentage of the people at the party are doing that?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah,
yeah, that's true.
Where the 100% full indication for marijuana is to get high.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and I can tell you,
for the pharmacologic effects, yeah. And this goes for the Delta-9 THC, the dronabinol, for it to have the effects as an anti-emetic, you have to create a high sensation. So when you give dronabinol, you have to generate the person to get to the level of a high for it to stop the nausea and vomiting from the chemotherapy. The same goes for the weight gain. You have to get it to a level of a high for it to then cause the weight gain.
And it is a dronabinol, or what is it, Marinol is the generic?
Marinol is the trade name. Dronabinol is the generic.
Oh, dronabinol is the generic. Okay, I had it backwards.
Dronabinol is the generic. That's the synthetic THC.
And so when you...
Which is available. It's been available by the FDA, approved, regulated, clean of any herbicide, pesticides, and fungicides because it's synthesized THC. And so it hits the receptors just like the marijuana THC does. But without all their herbicides, pesticides, and fungicides. Hmm.
And so when they take that, is it a pill? What is it?
Yeah, it's a pill. Okay. It's a gel-filled capsule is what is in dronabinol.
So do they feel...
And the maximum strength that we can sell legally in the United States as approved as the maximum accepted dose for an oral THC is 10 milligrams. And as I was telling you, Aaron, there's a company nearby me that sells 1,000-milligram brownie.
Wow.
There is no limit as to how much THC these people can put in any of their products. Any.
So you know, clinically tested,
that have 10 safe. 50 milligrams, 100 milligrams, and I would bet you that a child would not tell the difference between their lollipops with 100 milligrams of THC from any other lollipop.
Wow. You know, I have a kind of a relation to that. My sister just went through cancer and did the whole chemo thing, and I was a little bit surprised that her cancer doctor sent her to a pot shop to get the liquid form of marijuana so that it would help her with her nausea. Why would they do that if the pill form was available? Why didn't they just prescribe that to her?
Good question. Good question, because I can guarantee you I highly doubt her insurance covered the cost for the garbage that she received from the pot industry. She probably would have, if she had insurance, it would have covered her dronabinol expense.
And it would have had the same effect, correct?
Oh, absolutely, without the carcinogens, mutagens, pesticides, herbicides, fungicides.
Huh.
So, but also I would be very curious to know that person's practice. Again, I was an oncology pharmacist, And even the latest National Association of Oncology Specialists have rated and ranked the antiemetics, or the nausea and vomiting drugs, if you will, for chemotherapy. And marijuana, or dronabinol, THC, is an adjunct. It's way, way, way down the line of any product that you would recommend. Again, I think this is just the social hyping of what's been occurring in our media that has influenced this doctor, because he clearly doesn't know the national standards for antiemetics. It's dronabinol's
wow.
way off the page. There are several drug classes, five or more, that should be prescribed before dronabinol.
Well, because after we listened to you last time, we went home and it was like, all right, now wait a second, let's unpack that. All right, we've got to take a really quick break before we get to the top of the hour. I do this every time. We roll one break late, the next break later, and here we are. We have Dr. Drum as our hostage for the next hour, however, so we'll be covering this topic in full. If you've got any questions for us and you're listening between noon and 2 on Sunday, you can hit us on the chat room if you can make it work there. WeThePeopleRadio.us.
Sweet Jesus, one toll over the line. Sitting downtown in a railway station, one toll over the line. Waiting for the train that goes home, sweet Mary, hoping that the train is on time. Sitting downtown in a railway station, one toll over the line. Everybody just wants to get high. Sit and watch a perfect world go by. We're all looking for love and meaning in our lives. We follow the roads that lead us to drugs or Jesus.
Wow.
That's quite a choice.
It's not really much of a choice there.
No.
There's only one option.
I want to get back on this question I asked you about pot and cancer treatment, because I've known other people that have gone to doctors and been involved with chemo treatment, and they've sent them down to get either the edible marijuana or the liquid marijuana. Why would – I mean, obviously, it's not just one doctor doing it. Am I missing something? Why aren't they prescribing the pill form rather than an uncontrolled, unknown product for them to put in their bodies when they're trying to fight off cancer? I guess when my sister did that, I thought, well, wow, maybe there's something to this marijuana thing. If a doctor's sending her down there to help her get her appetite back, because she was losing weight like crazy. There's nothing else out there that will work, but marijuana's going to do
and
it.
And no pressure, but we have about 2 minutes.
Yeah, we got 2 minutes left, but we can pick it up after the break. But
maybe we should.
Yeah, because I'm confused here. I don't know why a doctor would do that.
Yeah, explain it to us.
Yeah, see what you can do in 2 minutes. We'll come back if
we'll
we
come back and do
well,
more.
Well, I say the media has a lot to do with this because again the promotion of marijuana, the uninformed promotion of marijuana, as I asked you before, were you people aware that, you know, medical marijuana has truly been around since 1985, not in the marijuana form, and none of you knew this. Now, I'm not saying the oncologists don't know this. They should know better.
Oh, yeah.
And after the break, I will read you what is in the Annals of Oncology in how to treat nausea and vomiting. The cannabinoid section as to exactly what it says.
Okay, and then Bob brought up a point too. Would prescribing the pharmaceutical pill for marijuana, would that set off some kind of alarm to the FDA that, you know, they're prescribing it and maybe they don't want the pressure?
No.
Is that?
No, it's a CS3 drug. In fact, dronabinol is listed as a CS3.
Okay. So that's not an issue.
Okay, so it's still inexplicable. We don't get it.
It is.
Again, it's the media and I think the public pressure. I think those are two key issues. But I'll read to you what the scientists recommend, and I'll also give you a major warning as to what happened here in California at UC Davis Medical Center with a cancer patient that took marijuana.
Yeah, let's do that.
Okay. Yeah, because, you know, that was like the number one, that was the drumbeat for this whole thing. You hate people with cancer. I can't believe you want to keep them from their medicine.
Yeah.
And, you know, the other thing, too, just for people who might not want to listen next hour, we have a huge amount of information about PTSD and the use of marijuana, and we're going to get into that next hour as well.
Might not be able to listen. Of course, they want to listen.
No, we're making them listen.
That's right.
We're forcing them to listen.
Good of you to get the drumbeat reference in for Dr. Drum, by
exactly.
the way.
Exactly.
That's right. We're going to come back.
Do what we can. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. And welcome back to the second hour of We the People Radio.
My name is KCNR, Shasta Redding.
Check. But I keep giving you the website so you can find the archive later. Bob's job to get the other stuff in there.
Yeah.
See, we all have jobs to
do. Including the legal identification.
Well, and Bob's got the fancy microphone now, as we mentioned, first hour.
I'm going to depend on him a lot now.
And Bill's our foil.
Yes.
Welcome, Bill, the foil. So,
we're talking about marijuana and the treatment of cancer, which I mentioned earlier, my sister.
Which was
just
the
gone
main
through.
Reason, supposedly, for legalizing it as a quote medicine.
Uh-huh.
So let's deal with that as medicine. It's funny, I have somebody in the chat room who says, "I'm crushed. All this time I thought pot was medicine."
Yeah.
I'm sure they're kind of joking a little, but honestly, this really debunks the whole medicine deal.
Yeah. I just was when my sister went through this and she told me she went with a friend down to, I guess, kind of a seedy part of town, which, again, you have a doctor who you pay a lot of money for to cure you of a major disease, and they send you down to a seedy part of town to buy a product that has no controls on it, and you don't know what you're buying. It really kind of blew my mind when she did that.
And our two new, well,
but however
one new vocabulary word, mute, it has mutagens in it.
Yeah, and she did say that when she took this, she did get her appetite back, and she did start eating. So I thought, wow, maybe this is cool. But I knew that what she was buying was just kind of a crapshoot. You don't know what's in it. So let's talk about the use of marijuana
and
cancer treatment. You said you had a lot of info on that.
Right. And I would just add, you know what the placebo response is from medication?
Yeah. Sure.
Oh.
Okay, so she could have had a placebo response. She could have also been weaning off her chemotherapy, so her nausea effects were going away, and that's why her appetite came back. There's a whole host of reasons as to why her appetite, and that's why we really need, you know, controlled studies when we use marijuana versus another medication to see that, is it truly medication or is this just a drug to get high.
Right.
And that's why we've had 20 years in California to do this. Have you seen the studies come out from marijuana and its effectiveness versus standard medication?
Well,
I haven't.
I haven't either.
Out of California, I don't pay a whole lot of attention to it.
But there haven't been any.
No. And so I think, you know, people that want to claim these, you know, multitude, like I said, what drug has more indications than supposedly marijuana has. You know, there isn't one. And so let's do the clinical studies and trials and see. And the reality is again, they've had since 1985 to do this because they were using it back then, right? We approved dronabinol back then. So they've had four decades to prove that marijuana works and haven't seen it yet. This is from the Annals of Oncology. Cannabinoids, dronabinol and nambolone, again, both of those drugs were approved back in 1985, possess weak antiemetic efficacy combined with potentially beneficial side effects, including sedation and euphoria. This makes them a useful adjunct therapy, meaning something down the road, in selected patients. In the ASCO, the American Society of Clinical Oncology, and the National Clinical Trials Guidelines, cannabinoids are recommended for patients intolerant of or refractory to, meaning resistant, to the serotonin receptor agonist, which is a whole host of drugs that came out in the early 90s. And if you remember before, I mentioned that multiple other drugs came out that really started to keep pushing dronabinol further and further down the line. So these serotonin antagonists such as ondansetron, crinecerfont, palonosetron, all of those drugs came out in the early 90s that really revolutionized how we treat nausea and vomiting and chemotherapy. So they have to be intolerant or refractory to those agents or steroids and aprepitant. Aprepitant is a new drug that came out in 2003. As I mentioned, again, we come out with newer and newer agents all the time. The serotonin agonists are so prevalent now, they're generic. They've been around so long, so they're generic, and their price has gone down. In a systematic review of efficacy of oral cannabinoids in the prevention of nausea and vomiting, cannabinoids were found to be slightly better than dopamine receptor antagonists, including the phenothiazines, haloperidol, and metoclopramide. Those are agents from the 1970s. That's Compazine. That's Haldol. Okay, that's Reglan. Okay, despite this, their clinical utility was found to be generally limited by the high incidence of adverse events such as dizziness, dysphoria, and hallucinations. So again, when I talk about risk versus benefit, there's a lot of risk, dizziness, dysphoria, and hallucinations to try and then get the nausea and vomiting to go away. Again, we have other agents that don't have dizziness, dysphoria, and hallucinations that they could take. Mm-hmm. As I mentioned, there was a person that died here in California. He was a cancer patient at UC Davis. And he was, we have various types of chemotherapy that we give people depending on their tumors that they have. And this person was... it was a blood dysgrasia, and those people undergo very massive amounts of chemotherapy and maybe even some stem cell replacement afterwards. But this guy died, and in fact, the doctors at UC Davis were saying they had multiple patients that had a very serious cancer fight that seemed to be more complicated as a result of what turned out to be a lethal fungal infection. And these fungi were growing on the marijuana plant. And it says they sometimes see 20 to 30% of the samples being sent through a lab contaminated with molds. 20 to 30%.
So are they ingesting this? Or are they smoking it? Or, I mean, how is, if they're smoking
I'm not exactly sure. They did say that they were users of medical marijuana.
Okay.
But again, these things also contain not only molds and fungi strains, but they also contain bacteria. And I think people that are closer to cancer patients understand you can't even bring in fresh flowers into a patient that's receiving chemotherapy for fear that they're going to contract the bacteria that may be growing in those fresh flowers.
Oh yeah, you can't even visit them. I mean, you have to. There's a point there where they have to be kind of isolated. I know my sister was. She had to be totally isolated for a period of time because her immune system was destroyed.
That's right. And so, as a result of destroying the immune system with the chemotherapy in attempts to kill the tumor or cancer that's growing, and again, they're at risk then for the normal bacteria's fungus, molds that are in our society that we breathe in every day. We have an active immune system. We can combat it. They cannot.
Right.
And so if they're being exposed then to these bacteria like Pseudomonas in flowers, that could kill them.
Hmm. Wow. So
why would a doctor
back to the original question.
I mean or why would they recommend that they do that?
I just read to you the Annals of Oncology recommendations from ASCO. Good question.
Yeah.
Because dronabinol is the agent to use, not marijuana. And even dronabinol is way down the line, as I mentioned, for products to consider for nausea and vomiting.
Jeez.
Wow.
So, I guess if you have a relative out there, or you, and you're going through cancer treatments, and your doctor's telling you to go use marijuana, you might want to look at what else your doctor doesn't know.
Why, if you're willing to, you know, and there are those people that are unwilling to accept Western medicine. Why, if you're willing to accept Western medicine, are you turning to marijuana?
Right. Well, because, you know, it's been around since the
Again, the hype, yeah. the media,
yeah.
the people being told, and this socialization, this recreationalization. Again, when we talk about recreation, to me, that's bicycling. That's going out into nature. That's recreating.
But
getting high and losing your brain function is not recreating to me.
But it's natural.
Yeah, right.
That's another one I hear. Is it's it's organic.
And then
it's natural.
You look at these grow sites. You look at the pictures of these grow sites in our national forest, and
they're littered with
so
pesticides.
So is poison and hemlock.
Yeah. Yeah, it's natural.
Have a little arsenic.
Yeah. Well, that's a great point, though. You look at some of these illegal grow sites in our forest, and they are absolutely
they have to wear hazmat suits. We have law enforcement and people that are dealing with it that are getting really sick just from eradicating the plants. They're not ingesting the plants. They're literally just cutting them down and carrying them away. But the stuff that blows off
them. Well, there is contact risk from the THC, because we know THC does get absorbed through the skin. It's fat soluble. So the THC would get through someone's skin, but the bigger concern are those fungicide, herbicide, pesticides that they're spraying all over these plants.
Yeah, it's the
poisons. So that the fungus, the molds, or the pests will not eat their product and thus lose their profits. Mm-hmm. So they don't care what they're doing because they're creating a larger and larger product, right? That's what they're attempting to do with this. They don't care what ultimately somebody is inhaling or ingesting later on. They could care less.
Right.
Hmm.
That's mind-bending.
That is mind-bending. That
let's take a really quick break, and maybe when we come back, let's veer into the PTSD lane, because we've got quite a bit of information posted on that, and that was a real eye-opener for me anyway. Because I know that's also being recommended as a solution.
I know. I've heard a lot about that.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. All righty. So we'll be right back. You are listening to We the People. Join us online while Bob over there, fortunately, I caught him unaware because I was sort of almost on time. How confusing.
Yeah, you totally threw me off.
How confusing and disruptive.
Not that awesome.
What was I thinking? Back. Okay. So, although marijuana is not legal at the federal level, we have doctors who work in a federal system recommending that veterans use marijuana to help their PTSD, and just a slight complication that if they happen to have it on them when they're on VA property, including the parking lot, they wind up with a federal drug charge. Little snag there.
But the doctors are recommending the use?
And after everything I've learned from having you on the program for 3 hours, let's see, this hour and the other two, I'm wondering, why are they doing this?
right?
Yeah, good question. I think they need to look at the research and the literature. We do have it. It's out there. As I shared with you, there was a study done at a VA in which patients were diagnosed and admitted to specialized veteran affairs treatment programs for PTSD. And they were assessed at intake for their marijuana use, and then 4 months after discharge. And they were looked at other covariate analysis such as their PTSD symptoms, their drug and alcohol use, their violent behavior, and their employment. And when they looked at over 2,276 cases, they saw with statistically significance that those people had worse outcomes in PTSD severity, statistically significant, and violent behavior that was associated with marijuana use, as well as measures of alcohol and drug use, when compared to those people that stopped their marijuana or never used marijuana. So those guys that continued to use after they were admitted for PTSD or started after, they were statistically significantly at more risk for having worse PTSD outcomes, more violent behavior, and more measures of use of drugs and alcohol. Well, so does that seem like an appropriate drug
well,
to treat somebody with PTSD?
Well, obviously no. And then the other thing that is so much of an issue, a lot of chronic pain with our military folks, and I'm not absolutely not suggesting it's not real. It absolutely is. But we have a lot of people with chronic pain. Now, since this opioid thing has become a big issue, we have a lot of people who are going from, you know, four pain pills a day, say. I have one guy, what was he, 10 a day or something like that? It was a really high number. I mean, I don't take them, so I don't know if that's a lot or a little. What it would
depends
feel
on the strength of the tablet.
Yeah, exactly.
So
I don't know what that
taking,
would feel like.
You know, 100 milligram morphine tablet versus 30 milligram tablets. You know, you think, oh, three is a lot. Well, no, the guy that's taking the 100 milligram tablet's taking a lot of morphine.
Right. So this guy was taking like 10 of these pills, and they were going to make him now, they were cutting it down to one per day. Same.
And again, that could be switching from what we call immediate release opiates to a long release, long acting type of product.
In this particular case, and I know everybody's different, but in this, because I asked some questions, and in this particular case, it was the same medication, but it was from 10 to 1 because of these new rules, et cetera, et cetera.
Well,
so,
in part, but it could be the same drug, like
right?
I said, morphine, going from morphine immediate release, 10 milligrams, to morphine sustained release, 100 milligrams.
Sure. Well,
it's the same drug, but it's just being delivered, and the way it works is the immediate release will break down immediately and get the buzz, whereas the long acting continues to dissolve and disintegrate as it's going through your intestinal tract, slowly releasing over time. What the drug addicts have found is that if you crush it, it now becomes immediate release. And so rather than having a 10 milligram immediate release tablet, you have a 100 milligram worth of morphine if they crush it. So the drug companies have been working now for several years on stopping that. But the drug addicts are always ahead, and that's what they've done in the past.
Well, and the tough part is, so when these changes are kind of radical like that, I know that opioid use, even though it was for a legitimate condition, but that use when cut back so severely, I know that there are a lot of people that utilize VA that have now moved into heroin use.
Again, we don't know the specifics of this case, and so I can't really speak to what's going on.
But I've heard it enough that I know it's not a one-off.
I would suspect there are other things going on in this case that probably you're not aware of.
Sure.
Because, again, step number one or recommendation number one from the CDC, Center for Disease Control, and when they came out for how we should treat chronic pain back in last year, 2016, their first recommendation was non-pharmacologic and non-opiate use. Okay? So you don't know if they're, and I could tell you from personal experience with patients at a VA in Fresno when I worked there in a chronic pain patient clinic, okay, it was myself and an anesthesiologist that saw the patients. If they needed a back injection, they went to the anesthesiologist. If they were staying on chronic meds, they were seeing me. And we also involved other non-pharmacologic treatments as well as non-opiate treatments in these patients. And you would be surprised on how well patients do with physical therapy.
Oh, sure.
And occupational therapy. Adjusting, for example, did you know, and I've had chronic back, I had a back disc problem for a while. Did you know sitting backwards on the toilet is a lot easier to have a bowel movement if you have a back pain?
Oh,
it is.
Okay, that's confusing. But, yeah, that would kind of make sense, maybe.
And amazingly, it works. And so those were little tips and things like that that we would, you know, get from our physical therapy and occupational therapy people. So, again, I can't comment on, you know, this guy's case that you're raising.
No. And my only...
There were probably a whole host of other things that they also implemented as well as downward adjusting their opiates. But also a whole host of other activities and things that should be done.
Right.
And again, some of these people think that, well, it's their opiate that's going to do it. And that's another issue in the recommendation is, recommendation number two is establish goals as to what the level of pain reduction is going to be and what the level of functioning should be. And so they have 12 steps in their recommendations that they recommend, and it goes over all of these types of issues. And I don't think most people recognize this. When you're getting a pain medication, it should not be going from a pain score of 10 to 0. That is not realistic, okay? And what's deemed a clinical success is a 30% reduction, meaning your pain score goes from 10 to 7. That's success. We should not be expecting to go down from 10 to 0.
Right.
That's an unrealistic expectation.
Right.
And I think a lot of people, unfortunately, have that expectation.
Well, and my only point in bringing that up is it's not that, and I realize there are a whole host of factors, and I'm not saying that it's any sort of a blame thing. My only point in even raising that issue is that that's the interplay between those two. You know, that's how you get into the pot realm, because I've also heard that. Well, now that I can't take as much pain medication, my doctor told me maybe if I start using marijuana, that will help. These things are connected. The opioid
right.
use and whether it's a pain pill or it's heroin, which just, I mean, when I hear heroin, someone's using heroin, I think of someone who lives on the street in Detroit. And I guess it mm-hmm. still blows my mind that these are high school kids.
Yep.
I mean, these are the kid yep. down the street. It's no longer like heroin, you know, like this scary, far, far away. I mean, you have to really make an effort to go to a place where people used heroin. It's everywhere now.
No, it's everywhere, and it's cheap.
And it's all kind of, but
yep.
it's swimming in a connected pool. And
yep.
I do not understand why medical professionals would and I realize a lot of the pot doctors are – I guess I'm going to say marginally medically professionals. But I mean, they're meeting with people in coffee shops and stuff. And I'm just curious why they would walk them into the use of marijuana when that just lowers the inhibitions and potentially helps them make some more bad decisions, you know?
Right. Well, again, I say, you know, again, it's the socialization of marijuana that's creating this. We didn't have people running around in the 1980s saying how great marijuana was, did we?
No, it was underground at that point. It was
right, and so therefore, you know, we didn't have this thought process going on in medicine. Again, medicine, you have to understand the medical doctors. Ask them how much pharmacology they got in training in school.
Mm-hmm.
Ask them. It's maybe 2 quarters. I took 3 years. Okay? That's why, again, we are the drug experts. The pharmacists understand the drugs. The physicians are diagnosticians. They diagnose. They also have the ability to prescribe medications. That's why they call it the practice of medicine. they also get educated by drug salespeople on how to use their drug. And as we're finding now with lawsuits being filed by states, and they're winning against the pharmaceutical companies for their inappropriate sales practices for opiates in the 2000s, they're losing. They're losing millions of dollars in these lawsuits now to the states because they're being shown for, again, the drug dealers that they were, and promoting their controlled substance inappropriately.
Hmm. So is marijuana, it probably is, but is it prescribed for pain?
No prescriptions. Remember,
right?
Recommendation.
Recommendation.
Yeah.
Right.
Where's the study?
Right.
The last I saw was moderate pain. So, moderate pain.
Right. So our doctors
is all it's going to be able to be used for, and those studies are not good. Mm-hmm. So let's see it go head to head against morphine.
Right.
Let's see it. Let's see that study. Come on, NIH, get to work.
Yeah.
National Institute of Health, let's see it. Let's see it, pot community. Let's see it go against morphine or Vicodin or Percocet. Let's see it.
Right.
Oral, their edibles, their 1,000-milligram brownie versus 10 milligrams of morphine. I want to see those people get couch locked. I think that would be very entertaining.
Oh, my gosh. When we come back, we've got to talk about couch lock. We're going to take a really quick break. Bill's looking at me with that funny look on his face.
Couch lock?
Yeah. He talked about it last time, but he reminded me on the phone about couch lock. And that also goes to some of the driving. Oh, my gosh, there's so much more. I wish you were on the phone with me a week ago. We'll be right back. You are listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
White lips, pale face, breathing in snowflakes, burnt lungs, sour taste. Lights gone, days end, struggling to pay. Long nights, strange men. They say she's in the class 18, stuck in her daydream. Been this way since 18, but lately her face seems slowly sinking, wasting, crumbling like pastries. And they scream the worst things in life come free to us, 'cause we're just under the upper hand. I'll go mad for a couple grams, and she don't wanna go outside tonight. And in a pipe she flies to the motherland, or sells love to another man. It's too cold outside for angels to fly.
Talking to that reefer man.
Reefer man.
Have you ever met funny reefer man?
Reefer man.
Have you ever met funny reefer man?
Reefer man.
If he says he walks the ocean, anytime he takes a notion, then you know you're talking to reefer man.
Wow. Is this as old as it sounds?
It is as old as it sounds.
What year?
It's Cab Calloway. I would have to look that up. But
all right. Back to that later.
I'd just say 40s.
40s, yes.
Yeah, wow.
Yes.
Gosh, they were joking about that back then.
You ride alone, you ride with the reefer man.
Exactly. Nice one.
That's back in the day when cocaine was legal.
So, yeah, well, yeah, my things have changed. Okay, so tell Bill about couch lock.
Yeah, what is couch lock?
Honestly, that explains a lot of the...
Well, we talked about BHO, the butane hash oil. which is a very high concentration of THC, whereas, again, in a joint in the 60s and 70s was, you know, 0.5 to 2% THC. Marijuana that you could purchase in Colorado now is up to 30% THC that you can smoke. But this is 80 to 95% THC in this butane hash oil, in which they use butane to strip the THC from the marijuana plant and create this goopy substance at the bottom that they will either use with a bong and a hot nail and inhale it, or they will put it in electronic cigarettes and smoke it. And again, one of these hits could be as equivalent to about 64 joint hits.
Wow.
What I'd like to play for you right now, so you can imagine this amount of THC going up to the brain. This is on YouTube, I found, and you see, it's a video picture of this kid. Looks like he's a teenager. He's surrounded by his friends, and you'll hear them in the background. And the camera's focused on him, and he's been stuck sitting on this couch, and he's frozen. He's frozen in this position, and you're watching this for about 15 seconds, and then this happens.
Wow.
How do you like that?
So he's screaming, I was just paralyzed, I was just paralyzed. But I'm assuming when his body couldn't move, his mouth couldn't say that, right? He had to wait until it
Correct.
Stopped? Okay. Oh, my God.
I mean, every time I watch that video gives me the chills. Every time. And I got the chills again. I just can't believe. And you heard, did you hear his friends in the background saying marijuana never kills anybody?
Oh, okay. You need to send me that so I can put it on the page and we can listen to it a little better.
Unless you're driving around with your buddies and you take a hit. And
yeah, there you go.
Yeah,
and no, you're the
and
one.
You're,
yeah,
and
you're the
paralyzed.
Behind
you're
the wheel.
You're paralyzed and you cannot move. Guess where you're driving?
Uh-huh.
Over and under and into and...
Oh, my gosh. I've never
and
heard
that was,
of that.
That was the result. You could see like a bong in front of him, and I think you can even see marijuana in a big bag in front of this kid. Again, he looks like a teenager, and he was just paralyzed.
And was that from smoking this hash oil?
I suspect. I don't know.
Huh.
It says it's under, it's called on YouTube, 2014 First Time Dabbers and Dab Fails. Compilation. So dabbing
yeah.
is what they call it when they're using the butane hash oil. So I suspect that's what happened here.
Wow, that's...
This is butane hash oil, and you see the results. And so there are cases in Arizona. I was trying to find it there on the break. I couldn't find it, unfortunately. But there's cases of little children, a child coming in. His parents were couch locked and was telling them that the younger child had fallen in the swimming pool and to please get up and go help him. And they couldn't.
Oh.
And that child subsequently went in to try and save his sibling, and that child died too.
So both the kids died?
Yep.
Holy criminy.
So you
and
look
that,
at all these people are at home smoking pot with their kid, you know, while their kids are home. Not with their kids necessarily, but...
Oh, they've left them in cars in Arizona and killed them in the heat. They forgot about them. Multiple times. There's multiple cases. Just
yeah,
go on. Just, Google it on the internet. You'll see it.
You know, it's funny. It's not funny, but you hear of all these places that get burned to the ground when they're
right.
making this with butane. And there
right.
is a actually an application in process right now for in a little community up north of us called Shasta Lake. And they want to open in their industrial park, a company wants to open a facility to manufacture hash oil through a butaneless process. So there will be no
yeah.
danger, but they want to commercially manufacture hash oil, and so that, you know, they need a city permit to do it. And of course, now that it's legal in California, we're gonna mass manufacture this now.
Yeah, and the reason why they're using butane right now is because it's cheap and readily available. Unlike they did with, you know, Sudafed, where they took it off the front counter and put it behind the counter for pharmacies.
Right.
Because they were using that for methamphetamine. There's been no restriction on butane in this state. Go and buy up as many cans as you want. Nobody's reporting it to anybody anywhere. Why don't we have a law, legislature?
Actually,
California legislature, get to work.
Yeah, actually,
let's see a law.
They are working on
limiting the amount of butane, and not only that, but let's report it to the Department of Justice when people are going in and purchasing the butane, just like we do with Sudafed.
Right.
Yeah, they are working on that. The who's really pressing it is law enforcement.
Oh yeah, and I would think, you know. Well, the medical community should, too. When you have a 30-year children at Shriners Hospital in there from butane hash oil explosions in your burn unit, I would think that would kind of push you to say, hey, maybe we should have a few less kids here from butane hash oil burns.
Yeah, because, well, and from a, also, again, from a law enforcement standpoint, those guys are getting injured. You know, the fire.
Oh, absolutely. Where they're walking in. Absolutely.
Uh-huh. So the fires, the toxicity, yep. There's a lot of chemical poisoning happening of law enforcement personnel that are dealing with the outdoor grows and the BHO plants in a neighborhood. I mean, how'd you like to live next door to a guy who's doing something that flammable, house blows up? Well, there goes the neighborhood, as they say.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And again, it's on Prop 65, we have a Proposition 65, which is the State of California Environmental Protection Agency. Chemicals known to the state to cause cancer or reproductive toxicity, again, that's the mutagenicity, and our good friend 2,4-dibutadiene, which is a byproduct of butane, is on that list. And so if these people are not clearing out all these remnants of the butane, this is what's being used. It's 1,3, sorry, butadiene, 1,3. It causes cancer, and that's, we've known that since 1988, and it causes developmental abnormalities in the female and male, and that's been known since April 16th of 2004.
So is that a byproduct of this hash oil? And so is it like a residue that's in a house?
Yes. It's in this goop of what they're using that they're smoking. And then my understanding is they also use this to create their can of butter and other things that they then turn around and use in all their cookies and other things. Start with the BHO to create those others.
Right. So if you're manufacturing that product in a house and you're all done and you walk away, does that house have like a chemical residue on
potentially
its surfaces?
Sure, potentially, yeah. I don't know how volatile this is and how long it would potentially last, or if you could eat it out, I don't know. But, yeah, oh, yeah, potentially. And, again, it's in all of your edibles.
Hmm.
It's in all these dabs.
Yeah.
A mutagen and carcinogen.
And, again,
Proposition 65, list the chemicals. It's right there. 1,3 butadiene.
And that's the same products that your cancer docs are saying, hey, go down, it'll help you get rid of your nausea. That makes no sense to me.
it starts to make less sense the more you think about it.
Yeah.
And as far as, I guess, gosh, do we have to take another break? What is happening? Are we time traveling? I don't know.
No, we're just staying on time.
Good Lord, every time I look up, I'm like, I was just checking the clock. I didn't really, Okay, we do have to do another celebration of capitalism, and that's okay. But there's so much more we want to know. We'll be right back. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Sometimes I feel like I don't have a part.
live in the city of angel. Lonely as I am, together we cry. I drive on the streets 'cause she's my companion. I walk through the hills 'cause she knows who I am. She sees my good deeds and she kisses the wind. Well, I never worry, now that is a lie. Well, I don't ever wanna feel like I did that day. But take me to the place I love. Take me over.
Doctor, please, some more of these outside the door. She took all my. Pursuit of happiness just seems a bore. And if you take more of those, you will get an overdose. No more running for the shelter of a mother's little helper. They just help you on your way through your busy dying day.
And that was, what, Valium back in the 60s?
Amphetamines.
Yeah.
Rolling Stones.
Yeah, mother's were, little helper.
Yeah, that was the doctor's.
Now they're singing about opioids.
God. Oh, we have a lot of drug music.
There's no logical reason that Keith Richards is still alive, but he is.
Yeah, that makes no sense. It's kind of like George Burns smoked till he was like, what, 100?
Yes.
Okay, so we've
it's
got
all genetics.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can't outrun the genetics, and you can't even ruin them, I guess. So I guess we did not talk about couch lock in the last program because Bill would have remembered. So apparently you and I only spoke about it on the phone, and I cheated our listeners out of it. And before we leave that thought, I mean, how highly likely is it that that hits people while they're driving? So sitting behind the wheel.
Could. It could. And especially with the use of electronic cigarettes. It makes it much more portable, and the availability for them to do it behind the wheel is huge. And which also I received this past week information on how the FDA is going to be coming down on electronic cigarettes, and get this, about its hazards for tobacco and nicotine. No mention of marijuana use with electronic cigarettes.
Oh, you're kidding.
Is the FDA kind of sticking their head in the sand? What do you think?
All day?
Uh-huh.
I sent this back to Bob DuPont. I don't know if that name rings a bell, but he is the author of the Controlled Substance Act in 1970. He's still around. I emailed him, Bertha Madras, a whole bunch of, Kevin Sabet, who's with SAM, and asked, I'm completely dumbfounded. Could somebody explain to me why the FDA is not mentioning electronic cigarette use and marijuana, please?
Mm-hmm. Well, now, electronic cigarettes, do they actually, I know they have a liquid in them, and then it vaporizes it.
Correct.
Does it do that through heat, or is it?
Yes.
It does. Okay.
Yes, and they have these cartridges that they sell again at the town right next to me. It's on the internet. And you can see these cartridges for electronic cigarettes. And I sent those to the whole gang and said, and here's the evidence that these are, marijuana is being used in electronic cigarettes. Hello.
Right.
So they're using they put the hash oil in there.
The response I got was, and these were big, very big people. Well, why don't you let the FDA head guy know?
Wow.
Why don't you let the FDA? It's like, you guys have pretty big names. Why don't you do that?
Yeah. Isn't
yeah.
That what we have them for.
Because who's protecting the public?
Right.
$64,000.
So they're manufacturing basically the little cartridges. And on those electronic cigarettes, do you like refill the little bottle yourself?
I believe so. Right. I'm not sure.
So you can
I don't
put
know.
Anything in there you want and
yeah.
vaporize
it. They have various things. They have. you know, from herbs to, again, nicotine, straight nicotine to tobacco products that they're burning in there. They have all various types of stuff.
Yeah, because I work with a fellow who's trying to quit smoking, and he's gone to these electronic cigarettes, and which to me, I'm not sure what the benefit is, because I think they still get the nicotine through the electronic cigarette.
So it'd be a way of trying to taper down. It's like with the patches and nicotine, right? You've heard of those that they slap on their arm.
Right.
And it's the same sort of concept. I don't know the efficacy. I think there has been some studies, but I'm not up on them as to how more efficacious. But there is a hand-to-mouth syndrome with smokers. And so whereas a patch on the arm isn't helping with that, the electronic cigarettes potentially could, right? If you're tapering down the dose of nicotine in that cartridge. And so they're still fulfilling their hand-to-mouth need, whereas the patch on their arm doesn't do that.
It's funny, I never even thought of the crossover between the electronic cigarettes and marijuana use. I guess there's no reason why you couldn't put the chemical in there.
Oh, absolutely, and they are.
Yeah.
They are. Hello.
It's
they
like
are.
It's an electronic
McFly.
Bomb now.
McFly.
Yeah.
Yep. And for the FDA to say, oh, we're going to make this big push for teenage use of e-cigarettes next year about tobacco and nicotine. And when I read that, like I said, I fell off my chair. I said, and you're not mentioning the word marijuana when you have half the states in the U.S. have approved medical marijuana? And you're just going to ignore it? I know the FDA doesn't believe in it, right? The FDA's come out and said, and they've produced the studies to say it's not effective as medicine. But to stick your head in the sand?
Right. Just let it roll over the top of you.
So what do you think now that half the states have approved? Where are we headed?
I think we're doomed. Yeah. I think we're doomed unless we have somebody wake up and read the medical studies and see the clinical evidence of it causing increases in hospitalizations, increases in deaths on the road, increases in suicide. Again, I mentioned this last time. It is the number one killer found in the bloodstream of teenagers in Colorado. Hmm. Marijuana exceeds alcohol.
So you say number one killer, how?
Suicide.
That it's found in the bloodstream. People are committing suicide. This is another reason why somebody with PTSD should not be smoking marijuana.
Right.
People commit suicide, also homicide. Remember, Chris Kyle was killed by a marijuana user, was shot. He was the American sniper.
Yep.
Was killed by a chronic pothead who was known to be very aberrant. Again, PTSD, using marijuana, and he shoots Chris Kyle. Again, found in 16% of ages 10 to 19 years of age from 2009 to 2013, in Colorado, the drug found most commonly in the bloodstream of these suicide victims, teenagers, 16% of the time, marijuana, 11% alcohol, opiates, 5.7%, 3 times higher than opiates.
Hmm. Do you think that may be just due to availability?
Oh, absolutely. They opened their medical marijuana shops in 2009.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 2012, they voted for the recreational. So this time frame is from 2009 to 2013.
Right.
This is the Colorado Violent Death Reporting System, Colorado's Department of Public Health and Environment.
And anybody who wants to look at
data.
Those studies, we've posted those. So
yep.
You don't have to.
This is reality land, people. Emergency room visits going up.
Yeah.
Hospitalizations going up. Addiction clinic going up. All this is happening in Colorado and Washington.
Pot bad.
Yeah.
Opioids bad.
Just wait until they get into it. They demand that they be able to use them at work.
Yeah.
Just wait.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That's
God.
Coming. That's
thanks
coming.
A million. We've
Dr.
been
Drum,
speaking
thank
with
you for
Dr. Philip
on.
Drum. And you can find all the information, including the archive of the program, here momentarily on WeThePeopleRadio.us. Thanks for listening.
By the way, Aaron, you were correct on the Rolling Stones. That the drug is assumed to be Valium or Milltown.
There you go.
Wikipedia said it, so it must be true.
I knew
yep.
one of those.
There you got it. It's on the Internet. Must be true.
All right, this is KCNR, Shasta Redding.
Say no to Couch Lock.